Thank you, I appreciate that.
No problem. All right, well, thank you all for cramming in here. I really think a lot of you are still disappointed that Randy's not going to be here, and I apologize for that. It's Jonathan's fault. So if anyone's upset, it's Jonathan@HighlandChurchOfChrist.org if you want to send an email. What we're doing here is talking about preaching to millennials. And one of the things you might have noticed is that the majority of people at the Pepperdine Bible Lectures this year are, guess what? Not millennials. Okay. And so maybe the question that we need to be asking is, why aren't we preaching to millennials? And so we have accumulated this motley crew of preachers to discuss the topic. And so I'm going to let them introduce themselves and just say briefly about their experience talking to millennials. So we'll start with you on the end, Mr. Shackman.
My name is Brian Shackman. I work at the Glendale Church of Christ, about 45 minutes from here, suburb of L.A. My experience preaching to millennials, our church has grown a lot in the young adult area and in the last several years. And so I just have experience doing that and running a conference specifically for young adults that Jonathan helps me with. So it's a blessing to work with them, but also it's a lot of challenges for sure.
My name is Jonathan Stormett, and I preach at the Highland Church of Christ in Abilene. And before that, I am a millennial as well. And before that, I worked at the Hills in Fort Worth as started a college minister and young adult minister. So that's my experience. It was my on-ramp into ministry was working with millennials.
My name is Naomi Walters. I'm at the Stamford Church of Christ in Stamford, Connecticut. It's right outside the New York City metropolitan area, so I also am a millennial. I think we're like the only millennials at Stanford also, so my husband and I. So they're around somewhere, ostensibly, but
they're hiding down hipster places.
They're hiding in Greenwich Village. and I do some adjunct teaching, so that's really my millennial audience is more in the classroom than in the pews. Mm-hmm.
My name is Colin Packer, and I'm the preacher at the Greenville Oaks Church of Christ in Allen, Texas, north of Dallas. Before that, I was in Denver, and so that was a climate that was a lot of millennials, just not in the churches that we've served. And so I think that's one of the questions about the title of this class is, what are we not doing to reach millennials? But I'm a millennial myself, and glad to be here.
And my name is Luke Norsworthy. I am also a millennial. I am a church planner with the Hills. Actually, it was the Hills helped get us started along with Golf Course Road. It's a church that's about 6 years old just outside of Dallas in a town called Denton. And it's a church that's average age is probably right around 30. So we've got a lot of millennials that make up the church that I'm a part of. Before that, when I was doing my MDiv at ACU, I was a part of an interdenominational Bible study that obviously was all millennials. And so it was an event. A lot of people, anywhere from 600 to 1,000 people were coming to. And so that's been my experience with millennials. Obviously, all of us are millennials. This is our age group. This is who we are. And so a lot of ways, we're talking not just from our experiences, but from our own lives, because this is who we are. And so one of the things that we've got to ask is, why are millennials not at our churches? And it's not just a Church of Christ thing. If you look at the statistics across the board, millennials are leaving churches. And if you talk to different people who do different statistical research, you're going to have different numbers. The point is the numbers are far too high. And so we've got to ask the question, what can we do to speak to millennials? So I think the question I want to start with, and for my illustrious panel up here to pose to y'all, is what are the things that are most important to millennials? What are the things that make millennials interested in what we're talking about and what we're doing? And so we're going to let you go first, Naomi, since you are the one working on your doctorate. So theoretically, You're the smartest one here.
That's not a theory. I think the most important thing, it's probably tied between authenticity and social justice, but I think they have some more stuff to say about social justice, so I'll leave that for them, and I will say authenticity for me. I'm going to get the cussing over with. They have a very good bullshit meter, so they know when they are being sold to. They have grown up with marketing. They've grown up with advertising, and they know when it's coming from a church, and they know when it's coming from a product. They know when they're being sold to. Mm-hmm. We know when we're being sold to, and we don't like it. We can see through it, and we would like some authenticity. So to be genuinely, passionately embracing who you are and being forthright about what that is, the good, the bad, the ugly, the great.
What do you think are some of, and this isn't just to you, but anyone can chime in, what do you think the things that we do as churches that come across as marketing or being pitched to that millennials go, wait a minute, this isn't authentic? What are the things that we do that kind of make that thing go off in their head going, we don't want to hear this?
Everything we do has a trendy name that makes no sense to anyone, right? So you come up with some title for some event. I mean, we're talking about titles. We have a new guy's going to be moving into our family ministry role, and next gen is what is a next gen minister, right? So some of the language we use even is off, but yeah. The branding, I think even the, some of the ways we welcome people into our churches can be seen as that. If it's not, if it's just, well, we'll get you in the door and we'll make sure we have all that at the door, but once you get inside, there's a cold feel.
Yeah.
It's amazing how, you know, 7 minutes into a church experience, people are going to make a decision if they're going to come back or not. So before I get up, it's so much more important that they really feel a sense that this is a community they can be a part of before I have anything to say. So that's what I've been trying to have conversations in terms of our people is your job in terms of greeting and welcoming people is going to be so much more important than anything I say or prepare to say in terms of first impressions and connection.
Hmm. Interesting. So when it comes to authenticity, that seems to be a central issue. Why do you think that's such a big issue for this age group? I'm going to go with you, Storm, and then Shaq, maybe you can chime in.
Yeah, I think it's... I don't know that we're that different than other generations with that, because if you'll pay attention to what we say, when we say, we've been sold to our whole life, we know marketing, so market better. Like, you're still going to communicate, right? Are you going to have a church sign up at some point? Or you can go to, like, Mars Hill, Rob Bell route, and not have a church sign up, and that is your way of communicating. Yeah. Become a secret church. And it works. That actually is a really good method, and it's also marketing. Here's the part that bothers me about panels like these. First off, the moderator. Here's the subtle thing that I think happens in panels like this. There, in every generation, is a sense of hubris that comes up. And I mean, if I was to be honest, I think the problem that millennials have, we got from the baby boomers. And they're repackaged.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, I think the biggest problems that we have are we can't be around each other. Like, it is a failure at an institutional level. And it doesn't matter if you put a cool name like Ecclesia on your institution. Which, by the way, that would be a good name for a millennial church. That's a good church. Mm-hmm. What I think I'm seeing is institutional failure at the level of we can't hang out if we don't agree on those things. I stole this from you a few years ago, but Paul never had to preach to a church of over five generations, and we do. And right now, if you want to preach to millennials, then just pick millennials and keep baby boomers and keep greatest generation away, because they get really sticky on other things that millennials don't want to, and the generations that are coming up. But here's the thing. The reason that bothers me is because I don't think this should be an option. At some point, I think we got to ask, are we doing church? Are we just picking a target demographic? And so...
And actually, that's one of the things that I mean by authenticity. Like, one of the only things that church does better than other people is intergenerational diverse. So
yeah.
The church is not the social center anymore. It's just not.
Yeah.
So we have friends other places. We can get teaching other places, but you can't get other places. What you'll get is a bunch of homogenous teaching and a bunch of homogenous friends. What church does is forces you out of your bubble. So I think it's just sort of, church is never going to be as good at entertaining us as entertainment is. Mm-hmm. And it's never going to be as good at providing us friends as friendship is. But it's going to be better at giving us church.
Yeah. So, Shaqman, your setting is Southern California. And so pushing people in Southern California in this age group to community, do you think that's something that you have to work really hard at, or is that something that comes natural to them?
I think it is something that is hard on some levels, because
so much of our communication is through technology at this point. So when you actually have a conversation with somebody, it's weird almost, and you feel a little uncomfortable when you're sitting across the table from somebody. But the word authentic, I think that millennials are craving something more than a Facebook connection or a Twitter connection. They're craving something more, and they want to find it, but they want to find it easily almost. They want to come in and just get to know you a little bit. What I found when it comes to connecting with specifically millennials, if I don't have lunch or dinner or get into their homes within the first month or so of them coming to our church, either me or someone that's really involved in our church to help them figure out a way to get plugged in, it's very unlikely that they'll connect with our church long term. I think Jonathan said we really need to be the church in that way, going out of our way to welcome people into relationships that aren't just a Sunday morning relationship. It sounds too simple to say, but it's just about cooking a meal, having somebody over, and that's so rare anymore, though, that when you actually do that, it makes a difference, and that helps them to see that what they're wanting may be at your church.
Now, I'm looking in the room, and I'm just going to guess. I'm not trying to offend anyone. I'm assuming some of you are not millennials, okay? You were born before 1980. But as you're hearing this as someone who's born before 1980, however old you are, doesn't it sound like a lot of these things are kind of the same things that, like, every age group wants? We want connection. We want to be real. We want to have transparency. Does it sound like this is not just one group? And I think this is part of what we're trying to point out, is this is a universal thing, but it's heard differently because we have heard for so much of our lives a sales pitch. We've been marketed at. And so the way that we hear things is altered and adulterated by that experience, which is different from y'all's experience, but the universal need, it's still there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was telling my wife what we were talking about on this panel, and she kind of rolled her eyes. She works at a marketing agency, and they're having the same exact conversations about getting their millennials to start working. She was born in 1983. I don't know what the cutoff is. I thought I was pre-millennial, but I guess I'm right there. she said in their marketing agency, they're having the same conversation. So it is in some ways comforting that it's not just the church having this conversation. That everyone's like, oh no, what is this weird group of people, and how do we get them to assimilate into our work culture and not just sit on the internet all day, basically.
Yeah.
So they're having those conversations. But it is comforting to know that it's beyond the church's walls, that everyone is kind of freaking out about this.
Yeah.
I also think it's like a life stage thing. So millennials are 1980 to 2000, which means they are currently 20 to 35. And that's just when people struggle with institutions in their, like, regardless of which baby boomer, Gen X, Gen Y, millennial, which cohort you assign them to. Just in the emerging adulthood phase of life, you're figuring out what you want to keep, what you want to toss, what you want to struggle with. And so I think it comes to a head because it gets called a millennial problem. And I think it's really just like a 20s and 30s problem.
Yeah. Well, if you've noticed that there's the Dan Brown books, the Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, anyone who's familiar with that, it seems like the underlying narrative of those books is we distrust an organization. We believe that the organization, whether it's in the Da Vinci Code, the church, that they would hide stuff from us, and we believe inside of us there's distrust for them, and so this narrative is plausible because we have distrust for the institution. That is, I think, magnified in this age group. And so there's a tension of, do we get rid of institutions? Do we deal with institutions? And you don't have a uniformity on opinions on how to deal with this issue, because I know in our work we're doing before this, there's some, you know, Jonathan's talked about the need for us to redeem institutions. And so we're an organization, and I'm going to ask you to speak into that in a second, but we're like a group of people that distrust organizations, but the way to reach them is through the organization that Jesus said you're going to save the world through. It's called the church. What do you think?
So there's a book by James Davidson Hunter called To Change the World. It's a good book, but probably most people wouldn't be that interested in it. But in a nutshell, here's what he's saying. We talk all the time about changing the world, but the very fabric of society hangs on institutions. And the very people who use the language of changing the world are the ones who are walking away at institutions and they're going to go start their own institutions. And the vast majority of, this is the tragedy, the vast majority of institutions that are being started today will only, by our most gifted people using lots of resources, will only last one generation. An institution exists to serve, to pass on a way of life from generation to generation. And what happens is people walk away from it, get together with other disenchanted people, start their own organization, it institutionalizes, and it finds itself too small of a mission. So, to answer your question with that, I think the way we have got to reimagine what institutions look like, and every institution you are in, how many of you are not preachers or ministers? Okay, good. You would do a church a great service by making sure you were offended every Sunday and accepting that, like expecting it. Does that make sense? Whenever a church is diverse, 100% of the time you will be offended. If we're going to pass on a way of life from generation to generation, expect to be offended. What I'm trying to say is expect in a diverse community of racial diversity, generational diversity, expect for you not to get your way. Expect for it not to be Gaithers or Hillsong. You know what? Does that make sense? That's where our institutional failure is at. And then the other thing I think would help for the church, and then I'll stop talking. I think institutions are subject to the principalities and powers, which means that we don't want to die. And sometimes we need to. Sometimes institutions can lose the very life they're trying to pass on by trying to preserve themselves at all costs. The 10-person church that I grew up in, I try to honor that church a lot. It is dead. Everybody in there except me and my parents have died. Because they didn't primarily concern themselves with their life, they were a great church. So at Highland and at the Hills, I noticed this in both of these churches, committed to things like giving away more than they keep. That's a little way of undercutting that institutional kind of self-preserving and actually having something worth preserving.
Yeah, that's good. Colin, can you speak into diversity a little bit?
Yeah, we've been a left-brain movement in so many ways, Churches of Christ. And it served us well in a lot of ways in a different generation. But we've been a head movement, and we're walking into a millennial generation that's so much more an experiential heart generation. And that's got to be frustrating for those of us who spent all of our lives. I mean, I went and got a degree so I could get that part right. And then you walk into a world where
people...
Why
am I greater than you?
We already established that. Okay. We're struggling with diversity here, too.
Okay.
But the thing that I'm struggling with right now in my own life is, you know, I've been so focused on getting it all right, orthodoxy. And yet, I don't know that my life's any better for all the right answers that I've gotten to, right? So I remember 4 years ago, I was kind of doing an inventory of my life and thinking, what do I want the next decade to look like? And my questions were, man, I want my life to look like Jesus, not just have all my answers in the right place. What does it look like to be a community that learns to not just get the answers right, but learns orthopraxy, right? Practice that's straight. And that's what we're trying to figure out, I think, in this generation, is how do we not just have the answers? That's important, right? But, man, I'm drawn to people who I can disagree with, and when I disagree with them, I still like them because they're actually likable people. There's a lot of people that get a lot of answers right. They're just not that people I want to be around. And if all that we produced is an orthodoxy that doesn't establish any kind of Christ-likeness, fruit of the Spirit in our lives, millennials are going to run from that like crazy. And it's something I'm struggling with, because sometimes the fruit of my work has been something that's not been as pretty in my own life or the people around me.
Yeah,
one of the that jumps right into the social justice piece, like tying that to...
Yep. We're going to come right to social justice in a second. One of the things that you see is our emphasis as logical people who want to get the right answers is you find yourself naturally having these debates with people who disagree with you. And so the conversation is, do you agree about this, yes or no, and therefore we determine where we see each other. When the emphasis is just on getting it right, you can't have unity. I think that's why the heart of what Jesus did, and which is one of the very best things we do as people from the Churches of Christ, is every Sunday we gather around a table and we have a meal. And it's not like you have the right issue about this, you don't have the right opinion about it, you don't have the right doctrine. It's that we gather around bread that is broken and the blood of Jesus that is shed for us, and that's the central thing that holds us together. And when that is the centerpiece of it, There's hope. But when you have this group of people that we've been a part of as Protestants, when the word protest is in our name, don't you see how there would be fruit of being a group of people who rally around protesting, that we would always end up protesting against one another? If we're people of the table, which is the best thing about our movement, we are about the bread and the wine. That's who we are. There's unity in that. And I think that's a bigger and a better picture, which I think all generations, but especially millennials, can get behind. And let's talk, you want to go to social justice now?
You just reminded me. Diana Butler Bass talks about how the church has historically operated, and especially Protestant, under the assumption that it's belief, behavior, belonging. So we have to get all our beliefs right and agree on them and figure it out, and then you get your actions straight. So once you believe the right things and you do the right things, and that's when you belong to our community. And Diana Butler Bass talks about it's the other way. Mm-hmm. Like you're in. You're a part of this community, and then your behavior starts to model after the community you're a part of. And the last thing you ever get right or get agreed on, if you ever even get there, is belief. So we've been working at cross purposes with the way that communities actually function, the way you actually make friends is to be friends and then to start acting the same way. Yeah. To start agreeing on things.
I mean, Jesus and the disciples, that's the story of the 3 years, right?
Yeah.
They're eating all the time.
They're around the table all the time.
That's it.
But do they agree on anything now? These people coming from all these diverse places, right? They learn to have to get along with one another, take a story as their own, and then that forms their life after. The Spirit has to bring them together in the end. They're worthless without the Spirit that comes at Pentecost, right? That's when things change, is after the resurrection. Mm-hmm. That's where the diversity
comes. Sorry, Colin. I love you. one thing that I've noticed about even what used to be, this is just non-Christian people, that you know, what I'm saying about belonging and belief, but now it's Christian people too. It used to be 30, 40 years ago, someone would move to a new town and they just look up Church of Christ in the phone book and then they come to your church. But now they come with a different expectation and different hope. Even if they are a Christian already, they want to belong, they want to see what you're about, and then they want to see if they align with that. And that goes into kind of the consumer culture that we're all coming from, but it's not just non-Christians, but it's Christian people that are giving your church the same scrutiny and criticism, and that's just reality. It may be a little hard for us, but it's the reality of how things are. The number one question I think that young people are asking is, what difference is your church making beyond the walls? And that's just moving to the social justice piece. And it's a really hard line to toe where you want to be genuine and authentic and not be over the top with, look at all the great things we're doing. But if it's just naturally a part of your church that you're constantly involved in the community, that, hey, we need people to help with this ministry, we need people to do this, every week we're involved in this, and it's just, you need people, and so you're talking about it a lot, then it's not something that's just, hey, everyone, let's see how involved we are in social justice, but it's just your identity, and people are drawn to that, because they're asking that question, what are you going to be on the board?
Yeah, and I like what you're saying, because years before, like you're saying, if a Church of Christ person moves to Denver, you Google, well, years ago you probably wouldn't Google, but you would, whatever people used to do to find things before, whatever that is. A phone book? What is that? I don't know. So you get this phone book, but we train people by, we gave them the theology to leave our churches because you were saved by grace, okay? It's all about grace. There's grace to have this and that, and you're not going to go to heaven just because the name on your marquee says Church of Christ. So we gave them the theology to leave and go to whatever church they want to go to. What we have to do now is give them a compelling reason to be a part of this group. It's not like trying to get them to stay or say you have to be here, but let's give them a bigger picture of what we're doing and invite them to be a part of that story. So, John, I'm going to come to you right now. What do you think it looks like to give millennials a bigger picture that they can buy into?
Well, first off, you got me thinking about, here's a question for us. Can a unity movement survive without being sectarian? Because I think that's the challenge that we have. Can a unity movement survive without being sectarian? Is there a strong center?
Flesh that out a little bit more. What's so hard about unity for...
Well, I mean, basically, unity means we don't want to be the only Christians. We want to be Christians only. Well, there's lots of Christians, lots of ways of being Christians. Yeah. I would imagine the number one thing you hear is the same thing I hear, which is my daughter, my son are now going to this Bible church or community church or something like that. And we have basically done what you said, which is the kingdom of God is bigger than us. So can a unity movement survive without being sectarian? Which, by the way, I think that's when we became sectarian. After the first generation of restoration movement, I think we started to realize we need to set some identity markers. And then we legalized those or became legalist about those and lost the ability to say this is a special part of who we are without saying, and everybody else outside of these walls is bad. I still think what we were trying to do originally still has captured my imagination, which is I like the work of the people being the church. You know, we have an instrumental service as well, an a cappella service, but part of the impulse behind that for us was we wanted more people singing, not less. We wanted to engage people's worship more. And it right now, you know, we'll keep rechecking strategy. But that's a big thing. Communion sacraments, I think when we gather together on Sunday, we think that matters in a way that some people in other tribes might not think. The table, we're really bad at it, but we just do it often enough it got in our bones. You know what I mean? Like, we are so efficient at the table, which is great. I love the way we do it. I love that somebody can stumble up there and mumble a prayer. Anybody can do it. There's no gatekeepers, basically, on stuff like that.
Can I interrupt you? Can you tell a story about the gluten-free communion?
Oh, yeah. So, at Highland, there's a lot of... We have a lot of people who aren't typically church background from right in, around our area. This one guy who always passes out communion sweatpants because that's just, I mean, it's funny guy. Passes out communion in sweatpants and is just a character. And we also have people who are not that guy. And he's passing out communion just a couple months ago, and this woman in our second service, this woman whispers to him, is this bread gluten-free? And the guy goes, oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, they're not going to charge you for this. and I do think that's something beautiful that happens at the table. You've got all these people coming together. So I think sacraments and our high view of assembly, our high view of fellowship, and our high view of worship as the work of the people, you know, that...
What do you mean, work of the people?
I mean, basically, you don't think I'm a big deal. You don't think your preacher's that big of a deal.
Hold on, my childhood preacher's in the front row. Let's not say that, okay? You're going to insult him.
I think
preacher was a big deal.
There's not this huge divide between clergy and laity, right? That, because part of what happens when you, if you don't show up on Sunday, there's not going to be worship. Right? And that gets into your bones. I think that's a special thing that we have.
Okay, so what are some other ways that we can give millennials an opportunity to buy into something bigger than, hey, we're just the right work church, we're the only way to get to heaven, but instead there's a bigger picture that we're inviting millennials into?
I think, you know, vocation, there's a lot of us millennial preachers that had series at some point about vocation. We're trying to say, yeah, one day a week matters, but what about the rest of the 6 days of the week? And millennials are wanting to ask the question when they go into the workforce, what am I going to do? What's the gift God's given me, and how is that going to make an impact bigger than just getting a paycheck? And I think the church connecting with that is really important, to let them know, hey, that's not some, you know, non-gospel honoring type thing. That's actually a part of the kingdom of God. And the story we told, the gospel we told, you know, Scott McKnight's written on this. He talks about it being the King Jesus gospel or the soteriological gospel, the salvation gospel. That's focused on individuals and salvation. If we can just escape this world one day, that's what God's going to bless us with. But actually, the kingdom message that Jesus brings is a message about God renewing everything, restoring all things. So what you do in your everyday life, your work, isn't just something you do to pay the paycheck of the preacher and missionaries overseas to do the real work of the kingdom. But how do we redeem people's vision to see, okay, you want to be a part of something bigger than yourself? That is something at church, but it's also learning to see your vocation in a larger way than what you've seen it before. And I think our kids are leaving school with that vision, our millennials, saying, what am I going to use this for beyond just the paycheck for my family?
That something bigger that they're connecting their vocation to is God's story, right? So church has often treated the text or the story of God in the Bible or the story of God outside of the Bible as sort of a band-aid. So the only way that it applies to your life is this sort of like therapeutic. You have this problem, let me tell you the solution to that problem, and that is a valid way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that that's not, but that God's story is not a band-aid for your life. God's story is the bowl in which you swim. And you can't not be in God's story, no matter what vocation you have. So that's what the church doesn't own God's story, but the church is equipped and called to tell God's story and to catch people up in it.
Yeah. But what you're hearing in both of these comments, like the therapeutic moral deism, which is, I think there's a professor from Baylor who talked about, that's like the main message that is often preached in American Christianity. And this, what McKnight talks about is the soterion gospel or whatever, the saving word, like just gets you to heaven. Both of those things, as you hear it, we're not talking about something big. We're talking about like God is reduced just to, we're going to get you to heaven when you die. This is like the eternal retirement plan. Do you want smoking or non-smoking? You go non-smoking for eternity. That's the right choice. And God helps you get there, okay? What I think we're trying to point to is like Jesus had a bigger message that we're invited to be a part of. And so I'm going to go to Shackman to speak to this one for 1 second. And then after that, if you guys have questions, maybe we can dialogue a little bit with y'all after Shackman says one more thing.
Yeah, I think that the big story is especially an important word for Church of Christ, partly because I think a lot of people in our 20s and 30s age range who have grown up Church of Christ, they define Church of Christ with a limiting story. We don't do this. We don't have instruments. Whatever it is, it's, right? We don't do this. Instead of a bigger story. And one of the things that I think I spent my first few years of ministry that was completely exhausting was I was trying to think of all these churches that are in L.A. that I call the hip L.A. churches, usually called by one word. And some of them look like dance clubs on Sunday morning, and I would function pretty well in that. But and you can look at that stuff and be so frustrated, and we can still define ourselves by what we're not. But I think everybody in this room, all the churches are represented, you have something to give millennials. You have something powerful to say to millennials. And I think the first conversation might be with your leadership for people on staff and just say, what is the gift that we could give this millennial generation? And get around that purpose and unite with that. Because if you define yourself by what you're not, or a church down the street that really does a good job of it, you're going to get exhausted and you're not going to live out the purpose that your church has. So it's important that bigger story is such a huge concept, because you can't just focus on what you're not, but what are you doing for the kingdom of God? What is your purpose that you can fulfill?
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, if there's any questions that maybe we said something you sparked some interest, we have a few minutes for that, and then we'll wrap it up. Not that we are experts in all things millennials, but we're willing conversation partners.
This past week, woman who I guess is a millennial or pretty close came to our leadership with the sense that she was looking for family. Mm-hmm. And then she sat down and proceeded to tell us in detail what that was supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. And I had this moment of clarity while we were talking, and you got to listen to that. I mean, that's important, what she's saying, that she cares enough to share that with our leadership, to take the chance to come in with a room full of men and put that out there is telling. But it also occurred to me, that's what we're all looking for. Is it family, but on our terms?
Yeah.
And that is sort of the clash that is constantly in churches now. I want family, and here's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Here's what that is. And McKnight was just talking about Dr. McKnight was just talking about the sort of salad bowl view. Were you, any of you there? For, he was talking about the different ways you can eat salad. You can put all the ingredients in separate little bowls, or you can put all the ingredients in a big bowl and then kill the taste with Italian dressing or ranch dressing or whatever. Or you can mix it all up in a bowl and then put just enough oil in there that the tastes of all the individual ingredients come out. Well, obviously, I mean, what's church? It's supposed to be that.
Mm-hmm.
We usually have it either in the little bowls or in the big bowl with the right taste poured on it.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, do I have a question? maybe I'm just making an observation.
Yeah.
And wondering if you want to respond to that. But you know, because, yeah. And here's what comes out. I say millennial, and that's not me, and suddenly that seems very foreign. That's a whole foreign group of people who I don't know anything about and have nothing in common with. And you guys just made the point, that's not true. We have a lot in common. We have a story that we're sharing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we then, you know, go about making that clear and making those connections? Anyway.
Good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
My brother, Sean Palmer, who I thought was here, but I think left, probably because
Randy's not here.
Something offensive.
Randy's not here.
Sean Palmer says the only antidote to consumeristic Christianity is mutual fellowship. And so I think the answer for so much of what we have is, church is a family, and you bring the best you got. Don't tell us what, like, we are one dysfunctional family. Who's not? And here's what if I could give one really practical thing for how to get millennials, you could replace that title with just about anything. It would be this: potlucks. And I'm serious.
Yeah.
Potlucks and inviting people over to your house. Like, don't let 1 hour on a Sunday morning be what church is for you, and then church won't fail. There's our institutional failure right there. And, like, I give my whole life to this hour on Sunday morning. I really care about making that a place that's, you know, but not just for that. And so when we moved to Highland, I've got a lot of stories like this, and I bet you do too. When we moved to Highland, there's this old couple named Brian and Diana Sweetland. And they adopted Leslie because she's a single mom on Sunday mornings. When we started having an instrumental service, this couple that's in their 70s, which is not their preference, started coming to the instrumental service to watch the kids that kick them. I mean, they get the sticker books and all this kind of stuff. And they're not perfect. And our kids aren't perfect. But they're trying to be family. And it happens. The problem is, if we're trying to fix it at a leadership level, it's impossible. You can't just say, everybody be family. But if you can keep putting that and creating, you know, at Highland we do HIP, Highland Intergenerational Potlucks. We do that a few times a year where we basically try to have potlucks for people, set out questions on the table like, what was the civil rights movement like? Or how'd you know your wife was the one you wanted to marry? And how do you program a DVD player? I mean, just stuff like that. Just create moments where you can, like, share life together, because we can't program family.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
So one book I'd suggest would be The Millennials by Rainier. It's a resource that would let you know a lot about this generation and just some things. But one of the things in that book that I think was even a surprise to me, but I see it as I think about other millennials, is millennials desperately need an older generation to come in beside them and mentor them. Mm-hmm. It's a desire we have. We have more mentors than many of you all ever had, because that wasn't something that was a value. We value it deeply. And so I would challenge those of you who are in a different generational spot in life, find a way to mentor young people. We really desire that. And the best young marriage groups, the best young adults groups that I see are groups where you've got a couple that's in a different stage of life that really take these people in. Because a lot of these people are moving away from their nuclear family. And to have a family they can come to on holidays and those different things in your church, you know, become that family for those people. And those young people, they'll be drawn to you in ways you'd be surprised by.
That's good. Final words, Shackman, Naomi?
In terms of preaching, I would say the theological piece is to say, and we're not just doing food because we like food. We're doing food because Jesus did food. Mm-hmm. Right, so we don't have these, like, floating ideas that we do because they're effective. We do them because it's what God does. God gives people food and drink.
Yeah.
And that parallel move can be made with just about any, like, we're not just looking for what's effective. Mm. We want to tell them. That's the preaching. So this is supposed to be about preaching to millennials. How does that 15, 20 minute chunk of your 1 hour, chunk of your 7 days matter?
Yeah.
You tell them their story.
Yeah. That's good. Good. Shaq?
Yeah, just on the mentoring thing, at a conference I was at a few years ago, someone asked the class, who are you discipling, was the question. And I think I didn't have a great answer at that point, and that's something that is really the fire under me in my ministry, and maybe something it would be a good question to ask anyone that's involved in leadership at your church. Just who are you discipling? Who are you mentoring? Who are you coming alongside? And when that starts to happen, I think is when millennials will see some great value in your church, because they're seeing actual life changes. One of the, I mean, I think it's easy to sit around and question what are they going to do. There's a lot of great things about millennials. That they care a lot about social justice. They care a lot about, okay, what is the purpose of the church in my life? What is the point? Why do I come here week after week? They want to get better and show improvement in their lives. So we can be part of that to help them along, which is really, really great.
That's good. Well, I appreciate you guys being here, because that means you have a level of interest in connecting with the millennials. And I think that's a beautiful thing. One of the things that we have to be grateful for is that we are stepping into pulpits and churches that were led by your generation and generations before you and generations before you. And we are grateful to have inherited, especially those of us from the churches of Christ, which I'm assuming is just about all of us, who have such a high view of the table, because we think that's central to who we are. And so we'll talk about this more tomorrow. We're going to vote two of these people off the island and replace them with Randy and Sarah Barton. So come back tomorrow. Harris.
Yeah, just thanks.
You heard of him? You know? You might get voted off. Okay. Thank you all for being here. Hopefully we'll see you guys tomorrow. Smart one.